Iran's leader issues a congratulatory message on the return of an Iranian naval flotilla from its mission to the Atlantic Ocean. The U.S. confirms that it has removed its most advanced missile system, including Patriot batteries, from Saudi Arabia in recent weeks. And Israel launches airstrikes on the Gaza Strip amid tensions following the recent escape of several Palestinians from a high-security Israeli prison. Welcome to World News. I'm Marcia Hashimi. Appreciate you being with us. First story takes us right here to Iran, where the leader has issued a congratulatory message on the return of an Iranian naval flotilla from its mission to the Atlantic Ocean. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei described the return as praiseworthy for the country's navy. The chief commander of Iran's navy says the flotilla sailed through some 45,000 kilometers during the voyage. According to Rear Admiral Shahram Irani, the fleet, which includes Sahan destroyer and Makran forward base ship, has arrived in Iran's territorial waters. He says the Navy's top priority is to provide security for commercial vessels by sending warships to high seas missions. Well, the U.S. has removed its most advanced missile defense system, including Patriot batteries, from Saudi Arabia in recent weeks. The Pentagon has acknowledged the removal of air defense system, but says it is maintaining, quote, tens of thousands of forces in the Middle East. Also in the statement, the Saudi Defense Ministry confirmed the withdrawal of the American missile systems. Now, the move comes as the Yemeni army and its allies and Ansarullah forces have stepped up their attacks on Saudi targets in retaliation for Riyadh's attacks and airstrikes on Yemen. The removal of the U.S. air defense system from Saudi Arabia also comes hot on the heels of the pullout of American troops from Afghanistan. Well, families of the victims of the 9/11 attacks in the U.S. are expecting their government to release an FBI report on the possible role of Saudi Arabia on this, the 20th anniversary of the attacks. The families are suing the Saudi government for complicity in the attacks that killed nearly 3,000 people. The 16-page report is an analysis of the FBI's investigation into the activities of two Saudi hijackers. The report is expected to provide details on other Saudis who helped the pair in California in 2000. The family's lawyers believe that they can prove that a group of Saudi officials had conspired with the two al-Qaeda operatives. President Joe Biden ordered the release last week, this after the victims' families said the U.S. president would not be welcomed at anniversary memorials. Now, the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says the Zionist regime cannot stop Gaza and resistance groups from supporting Palestinians in their fight for national issues. The reaction came after Israeli warplanes carried out fresh airstrikes on the besieged Gaza Strip last night. Our correspondent Ashraf Shannon brings us more.
Israeli fighter jets attacked the central Gaza Strip refugee camp of Deir el-Balah and also an area west of the southern Gaza Strip town of Khan Yunis, targeting a security post that belonged to Hamas's military wing, the Zin Qassam Brigades, and also the Islamic Jihad military wing, the Al-Quds Brigades. The Israeli regime claimed that a rocket was fired from Gaza, and they accused the Islamic Jihad of firing that rocket.
Well, Israel says it has arrested two more Palestinian inmates who escaped the regime's Gilboa prison. That brings the number of recaptured prisoners to four. Israeli forces said the escapees were captured in a truck parking lot on Saturday morning. Two other Palestinian prisoners were detained near the city of Nazareth on Friday, but two others remain at large. Israel has been conducting a massive manhunt since Monday when six prisoners tunneled out of one of the regime's highest security prisons. Meanwhile, Palestinians say they have shot down an Israeli drone west of the city of Ramallah. Palestinian resistance groups say these developments signal a new round of explicit conflict with the occupying regime. Well, Palestinian groups are warning Israel against harming the recaptured prisoners who had broken out of a maximum security prison last week. Hashtag Trending is next with a review of social media reactions to the story.
Hey everyone, Ali Reza here, back with another Hashtag Trending, and today we'll bring you the word on the cyber world about Israel's systemic harassment of Palestinian prisoners. Stay with me. Tel Aviv says they have now arrested four of the six Palestinians who had broken out of a maximum security prison a few days earlier in a Hollywood-style escape that humiliated Israel's security apparatus. Palestinians are now heard saying that their rearrest will not break their will. Other voices have also warned Israel against laying as much as a finger on them. They say that such an act would potentially amount to a declaration of war against the Palestinians. Anyways, let's check out the first comment for the day by Quds News Network. They wrote, Islamic Jihad's spokesperson Dawood Shihab, arresting the two heroes will not remove the defeat that the occupation army had when the occupation security system was broken through a legendary operation. Hashtag Gilboa Prison Break. MC Hawk wrote, Hamas spokesperson Abdul Latif Kanoa, arresting two of the freed prisoners will not wash the shame of the occupation. They should be proud enough that they broke the reputation and security system of the occupation state. Here we have a comment by Muhammad Al-Kabir. He said, a protest in Al-Duhaysha refugee camp in Bethlehem in solidarity with two of the six Gilboa prison breakers who have been rearrested. Their last week prison break reminded many of the iconic escape scene from the 1994 masterpiece Shawshank Redemption, with one huge difference. This one actually happened, sans all the theatrics. Now, this is the reason why this escape, this prison break, will be burned in the minds of all Palestinians and Israelis alike. Now, let's start the next batch of comments with one by ARK. They wrote, break those prison doors where the fascist regime imprisoned people. Our next comment comes from Joe. He wrote, it shows how weak evil Israel terrorists really are. Soon Hamas will defeat evil Israel, so Palestinians will take back all stolen lands from 73 years ago and be free again in Palestine. Our next comment comes from Viv Mayer. They wrote, an Israeli police officer tramples the body of martyr Hazam al-Julani, a Palestinian medical doctor, after the latter was shot dead by Israeli gunfire in the old city of occupied Jerusalem al-Quds. Well, not gonna lie, this one was kind of sick. I mean, what kind of threat could a dead body pose to a soldier unless he thought he was trophy hunting? I mean, that's what it looked like from where I'm standing. Anyways, we have another cringe-worthy bit of video in the next tweet. They wrote, video shows Jewish people chanting death to Arabs in central Jerusalem. How would they have reacted if the story was vice versa? All right, our final comments of the day are in reply to this video. The first one by Billy Boy reads, U.S. and state governments support this form of systemic racism by majority European descent white Israelis against Arabs, i.e. North African descent black people who are native to the region. No reason why they can't get along except racism is policy. Our final comment comes from JHUVZ. It reads, all Israeli or soon will wipe on the map and let the Palestinians free from terrorist Israeli Jews. Well, that's going to be it for this edition of Hashtag Trending. Thanks for sticking around this far. Until next time, take care and bye-bye.
Well, the Yemeni army has revealed details of the third phase of a large-scale military operation to liberate the Ma'arib government. Well, the army spokesman said Yemeni troops assisted by tribal forces have managed to liberate two districts of the northeastern government. Some 150 mercenaries recruited by the Saudi-led coalition were killed or injured, and many more captured. The Saudi-led coalition launched 37 airstrikes to bring the Yemeni operation to a halt, but to no avail. The spokesman says the army is working to bring life back to normal in liberated areas. Brigadier General Saadi vowed that the armed forces are determined to liberate all areas occupied by the Saudi-led aggressors and to guarantee Yemen's independence. Well, an Afghan resistance commander has vowed that the fight against the Taliban will continue despite the fall of the last major opposition holdout. Saleh Rajasthani says resistance fighters in the Panjshir Valley will fight the Taliban to the death. He says the presence of the Taliban in Panjshir does not mean the fight has ended, rather it is just beginning. The commander urged the international community not to recognize Taliban rule. The mountainous region north of Kabul was captured by the Taliban last week. The group overran the Afghan capital in mid-August amid the withdrawal of U.S.-led foreign forces. A new report has raised doubt on the U.S. military's account of targeting the alleged planner of last month's bomb attack in Afghanistan. The New York Times says it has conducted a video analysis that shows the suspect claimed to have been loading explosives into his car was actually handling water canisters. It also identifies the suspect as an aid worker. The report questions the U.S. military's account that claims explosives were present on the scene of the drone strike, which caused the second blast. The probe suggests 10 civilians, seven of them children, lost their lives in the U.S. attack, and that's compared to Washington's estimate of three civilian deaths. The U.S. said it was retaliating against the August 26th strike claimed by Daesh that killed over 180 people, including 13 American service members. The United Nations has appealed for an injection of cash into Afghanistan to avoid an economic meltdown there.
We need to find ways to avoid a situation that would be catastrophic for the people and, in my opinion, a source of instability and an excellent gift for terrorist groups still operating there.
Antonio Guterres says that he is in talks with the chief of the International Monetary Fund, adding it is essential to agree on waivers or mechanisms to get money into Afghanistan. The IMF has blocked the Taliban from assessing some $440 million in new emergency reserves. Guterres said the UN believes that dialogue with the Taliban is absolutely essential at the present moment. Meanwhile, the World Food Program has warned that one-third of the population in Afghanistan faces acute food insecurity.
Surveys we were doing before the 15th of August indicated that 81% of households were not consuming sufficient food. After the 20th of August, up until the 5th of September, that number went up to 93%.
Anthea Webb stressed the malnutrition already affects one in two children under the age of five in the country. She said three out of four households are using extreme coping mechanism, such as skipping meals or preferring to give food to their children instead of the adults. Now the agency's latest assessment says 15 of Afghanistan's 34 provinces have shown less food consumption during the past month. Moving on to other news this hour. Iran has reported more than 16,000 new coronavirus infections, a sharp decline in cases since the country was hit by the Delta variant. Well, the figure brings the total caseload to 5.2 million. 444 people have died from the disease during the past day. The overall death tally is hovering around 114,000. This as the vaccination drive is gathering pace with more than 22 million doses of vaccines administered so far. Iran faced the fifth peak of COVID-19 in mid-August, with a number of infections standing at over 50,000 and the number of deaths at over 700. The Delta variant is blamed for the surge. The U.S. president has issued a vaccine mandate, which would apply to about two-thirds of all American employees. The decision has drawn criticism from senior Republicans who are threatening to sue the Democratic administration. In the meantime, the fate of the U.S. economy is hanging in the balance.
The coronavirus pandemic has not only cost countless lives, but has hit the world economy hard. The United States, which has the world's biggest economy, hasn't been an exception. The U.S. is the world's worst-hit nation by the pandemic. Under former President Donald Trump, the country launched a program called Operation Warp Speed to facilitate and accelerate the production and distribution of COVID-19 vaccines. U.S. pharmaceutical companies developed several vaccines and rolled them out to the country's population. Trump's successor, Joe Biden's administration, set a target of vaccinating 70% of the country's population, at least partially, by the 4th of July. However, the country met the target a month later despite generous incentives given to Americans.
At least 40% of the U.S. population is a victim of a lot of silly conspiracy theories about the vaccine and are adamant about not taking the vaccine. It's a big problem in the U.S. that's been stoked by social media and QAnon and, you know, career right-wing politicians who are manipulating it all for their personal gain. So the U.S. Is confronting with this real problem.
The vaccination program proved effective at bringing down the daily COVID cases and deaths, but up to a certain point. The highly infectious Delta variant of the coronavirus sent a new wave of cases and fatalities across the world. Scrambling to contain the spiraling outbreak, President Biden announced new mandatory vaccination plans on Thursday.
I will sign an executive order that will now require all executive branch federal employees to be vaccinated. All. And I've signed another executive order that will require federal contractors to do the same. If you want to work with the federal government and do business with us, get vaccinated.
But in addition to saving lives, the U.S. government is aiming at saving the economy, too.
Well, it certainly would help because we have a problem going on of a lot of workers not wanting to go back to work now that the COVID Delta variant is accelerating a lot of places in the country. That was obvious in the last month's job report.
The mandatory vaccination program has triggered a backlash from American conservatives.
And with that, that brings us to the end of this World News Edition. Thanks so much for staying tuned.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. It was the last known missile fired by the United States in its 20-year war in Afghanistan, and the U.S. military called it a righteous strike a drone attack after hours of surveillance on 29th of August against a vehicle that American officials thought contained an ISIS bomb and posed an imminent threat to U.S. troops at Kabul airport. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Matthew Akins, Christopher Cottle, Evan Hill, and Eric Schmidt. The piece is titled New York Times Investigation in U.S. Drone Strike Evidence Suggests No ISIS Bomb. Stay with us for more. It was the last known missile fired by the United States in its 20-year war in Afghanistan, and the U.S. military called it a righteous strike, a drone attack after hours of surveillance on 29th of August against a vehicle that American officials thought contained an ISIS bomb and posed an imminent threat to U.S. troops at Kabul airport. But a New York Times investigation of video evidence, along with interviews with more than a dozen of the driver's co-workers and family members in Kabul, raises serious doubts about the U.S. version of the events, including whether explosives were present in the vehicle, whether the driver had a connection to ISIS, and whether there was a second explosion after the missiles struck the car. Military officials said they did not know the identity of the car's driver when the drone fired, but deemed him suspicious because of how they interpreted his activities on that day, saying that he possibly visited an ISIS safe house and, at one point, loaded what they thought could be explosives into his car. The New York Times reporting has identified the driver as Zamari Ahmadi, a long-time worker for a U.S. aid group. The evidence suggests that his travels that day actually involved transporting colleagues to and from work, and an analysis of video feeds showed that what the military may have seen was Mr. Ahmadi and a colleague loading canisters of water into the trunk of his car to bring home to his family. While the U.S. military said the drone strike might have killed 3 Afghan civilians, New York Times reporting shows that it killed 10, including 7 Afghan children, in a dense residential block. Mr. Ahmadi, a 43-year-old, had worked since 2006 as an electrical engineer for Nutrition and Education International, a California-based aid group. The morning of the strike, Mr. Ahmadi's boss called from the office at around 8:45 a.m. and asked him to pick up his laptop. I asked him if he was still at home, and he said yes. The country director said in an interview at Nutrition and Education International's office in Kabul, Afghanistan. Like the rest of Mr. Ahmadi's colleagues, he spoke of condition of anonymity because of his association with an American company in Afghanistan. According to his relatives, that morning, Mr. Ahmadi left for work around 9 a.m. in a white 1996 Corolla that belonged to Nutrition and Education International, departing from his house where he lived with his 3 brothers and their families, a few kilometers west of Kabul airport. U.S. officials told the New York Times that it was around this time that their target, a white sedan, first came under surveillance after it was spotted leaving a compound identified as an alleged ISIS safe house about 5 kilometers northwest of Kabul airport. It is unclear if officials were referring to one of the 3 stops that Mr. Ahmadi made to pick up 2 passengers and a laptop on his way to work. The latter location, the home of Nutrition and Education International's country director, was close to where a rocket attack claimed by ISIS would be launched against the airport the following morning from an improvised launcher concealed inside the trunk of a Toyota Corolla, a model similar to Mr. Ahmadi's vehicle. A New York Times reporter visited the director at his home and met with members of his family, who said they had been living there for more than 40 years. "We have nothing to do with terrorism or ISIS," said the director, who also has a U.S. resettlement case. "We love America and we want to go there." Throughout the day, an MQ-9 Reaper drone continued to track Mr. Ahmadi's vehicle as it drove around Kabul, and U.S. officials claimed they intercepted communications between the sedan and the alleged ISIS safe house, instructing it to make several stops. But the people who rode with Mr. Ahmadi that day said that what the military, U.S. military, interpreted as a series of suspicious moves was in fact simply a normal day at work. After stopping to pick up breakfast, Mr. Ahmadi and his two passengers arrived at Nutrition and Education International's office, where security camera footage obtained by the New York Times recorded their arrival at 9:35 a.m. Later that morning, Mr. Ahmadi drove some co-workers to a Taliban-occupied police station downtown, where they said they requested permission to distribute food to refugees in a nearby park. Mr. Ahmadi and his three passengers returned to the office around 2 p.m. As seen on camera footage, Mr. Ahmadi came out a half hour later with a hose that was streaming water. With the help of a security guard, he filled several empty plastic containers with water. According to his co-workers, water deliveries had stopped in his neighborhood after the collapse of the Afghan government, and Mr. Ahmadi had been bringing home water from the office. "I filled the containers myself and helped him load them into the trunk of his car," the security guard said. At 3:38 p.m., the security guard and another co-worker moved the car further into the driveway. The camera footage ends soon after, when the office shut off its generator at the end of the workday and Mr. Ahmadi and three passengers left for home. Around this time, U.S. officials said that the drone had tracked Mr. Ahmadi to a compound 8 to 12 kilometers southwest of Kabul Airport, a location that matched Nutrition and Education International's office. There, they said the drone observed Mr. Ahmadi and three others loading heavy packages into the car, which they believed might contain explosives. But the passengers said that they had only two laptops with them, which they put inside the vehicle, and that the trunk of the car had no other cargo than the plastic water-filled containers that were placed there earlier. In separate interviews, all three passengers denied loading explosives into the vehicle they were about to commute home in. According to one of Mr. Ahmadi's passengers, a colleague who regularly commuted with him, the ride home was filled with their usual laughing and banter, but with one difference. Mr. Ahmadi kept the radio silent as he was afraid of getting in trouble with the Taliban. "He liked cheerful music," the colleague said. "That day we couldn't play any music in the car." Mr. Ahmadi dropped off his three passengers and then headed for his home near Kabul Airport. "I asked him to come in for a bit, but he said he was tired," the last passenger said. Although U.S. officials said that at that point they still knew little about Mr. Ahmadi's identity, they had become convinced that the white sedan he was driving posed an imminent threat to U.S. troops at Kabul Airport. When Mr. Ahmadi pulled into the courtyard of his home, which officials said was different than the alleged ISIS safe house, the tactical commander made the decision to strike the vehicle, launching a Hellfire missile at around 4:50 p.m. Although the target was now inside the densely populated residential area, the drone operator quickly scanned and saw only a single adult male greeting the vehicle, and therefore assessed with reasonable certainty that no women, no children, or non-combatants would be killed, according to U.S. officials. But according to Mr. Ahmadi's relatives, as Mr. Ahmadi pulled into his courtyard, several of his children and his brother's children came out, excited to see him, and sat in the car as he backed it inside. Mr. Ahmadi's brother, Romal, was sitting on the ground floor and his wife when he heard the sound of the gate opening and Mr. Ahmadi's car entering. His adult cousin, Nasser, had gone to fetch water for his ablutions and greeted him. The car's engine was still running when there was a sudden blast and the room was sprayed with shattered glass from the window, Romal recalled. He staggered to his feet. "Where are the children?" he asked his wife. "They're outside," she replied. Romal ran out into the courtyard. He saw that his nephew, Faisal, a 16-year-old teenager, had fallen from the exterior staircase, his torso and head grievously wounded by shrapnel. He wasn't breathing. Amid the smoke and fire, he saw another dead nephew before neighbors arrived and pulled him away, he said. Since the strike, U.S. military officials justified their actions by citing an even larger blast that took place afterwards. Because there were secondary explosions, there is reasonable conclusion to be made that there was explosives within the vehicle, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Mark Milley, said last week. But an examination of the scene of the strike, conducted by the New York Times visual investigation team and a New York Times reporter the morning afterwards, and followed up with a second visit 4 days later, found no evidence of a second, more powerful explosion. Experts who examined photographs and videos pointed out that although there was clear evidence of a missile strike and subsequent vehicle fire, there were no collapsed or blown-out walls, no destroyed vegetation, and only one dent in the entrance gate indicating a single shockwave. It seriously questions the credibility of the intelligence or technology utilized to determine this was a legitimate target, said Chris Cobb-Smith, a British Army veteran and security consultant. While the U.S. military has so far acknowledged only 3 Afghan civilian casualties, Mr. Ahmadi's relatives said that 10 members of their family, including 7 children, were killed in the U.S. strike. Mr. Ahmadi, the 3 of his children, Zamir, 20 years old, Faisal, 16-year-old, and Farzad, 10 years old, Mr. Ahmadi's cousin, Nasser, 30-year-old, 3 of Romal's children, Arwin, 7 years old, Benjamin, 6 years old, and Hayat, 2-year-old, and 2 3-year-old girls, Malikir and Somayir. Neighbors and an Afghan health official confirmed that bodies of children were removed from the site. They said the blast had shredded most of the victims. Family members questioned why Mr. Ahmadi would have a motivation to attack American troops when he had already applied for refugee settlement in the United States. His adult cousin Nasser, a former U.S. military contractor, had also applied for resettlement in the United States. He had planned to marry his fiancée, Samia, last Friday so that she could be included in his immigration case. "All of them were innocent," said Emal, Mr. Ahmadi's brother. "You say he was an ISIS member, but he actually worked for the Americans."
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program The Key here at IRIB English Radio. I'm your host, Shiraz Agha. Thank you for joining us here today. Here at The Key and IRIB English Radio, we would like to offer our condolences to our listeners on the most grave month of Safar, which follows the month of Muharram, and altogether the month of Safar, the month of Muharram. These 2 months are months in which we commemorate the the death and the martyrdom of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Today on The Key, we would like to examine a very important question and a very important and significant topic, and that is the virtues and distinctions of Imam Hussein. We know that Imam Hussein alayhi salam holds a very special place amongst the Imams and all of the friends of God. And there's a reason for this. The reason is the various distinctions and virtues that he has. Today we're going to be looking at some of these. One of the virtues which has been mentioned for Imam Hussein is that the tawassul to Imam Hussein is considered to be one of the closest ways to attain proximity to God Almighty. When we make tawassul and intercession, seek intercession to Imam Hussein, this act has been considered one of the most quickest, one of the quickest ways to achieve proximity and qurb to God Almighty. Another virtue which has been mentioned for Imam Hussein is that seeking his help is considered the key to the resolution to all problems. Another virtue which has been mentioned for Imam Hussein is that the dust from the grave of Imam Hussein, prostrating upon it in the prayers, is considered a virtue and leads to the increase in the reward of the prayers. This is another virtue of Imam Hussein, and also the virtue of the grave and the shrine of Imam Hussein. In fact, related to this, it's also been mentioned that one of the virtues of Imam Hussein is that it's considered, in Islamic jurisprudence, it's considered impermissible to eat dust or to eat dirt. But the only exception that has been made to this is that it's okay to eat a minute speck of dust from the grave of Imam Hussein if this is performed with the intention of being cured from an illness. Another virtue which has been mentioned for Imam Hussein is that Imam Hussein is the only, when he was born, he was the only newborn upon whose birth his grandfather, his father, and his mother cried. We know that when a baby is born, everybody's happy, the father is happy, the mother is happy, all of the relatives are happy. But during the birth of Imam Hussein, we see that Imam Hussein, his father, his mother, and his grandfather, may God's peace be upon all of them, cried because of what would happen to him in the future. One of the virtues which has been mentioned for Imam Hussein is that the punishment which will be inflicted upon the killers of Imam Hussein will be more than the punishment inflicted upon all of the other inhabitants of hell. Another virtue which has been mentioned for Imam Hussein is that Imam Hussein alayhi salam is the first Imam who will return amongst the Imams from on the Raj'at, which is a concept in Tashayyu which refers to the return of all of the Imams. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the virtues of Imam Hussein. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat, or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
The American presence in war-ravaged Afghanistan, often described as a graveyard of empires, not only failed to wipe out the threat of terrorism, but actually fanned its flames. We now present you an article written by Sayed Zafar Mahdi, a Tehran-based journalist, editor, and blogger with over 12 years of experience, who has reported extensively from Kashmir, India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Iran for leading publications worldwide. The piece is titled, How Post-9/11 U.S. War on Terror Spawned Terrorism. Nasty, brutish, and long-drawn-out American war on terrorism that began in the wake of the suspicious 9/11 attacks 20 years ago has only spawned more terrorism and more insecurity. The military invasion of Afghanistan started with the Pentagon carpet-bombing the landlocked country with B-52 heavy bombers and gunships. The disastrously misguided and disproportionate response to the cataclysmic events of 9/11 found expression in the so-called Global War on Terror, which has since consumed tens of thousands of lives from Afghanistan to Iraq and elsewhere. The nasty, brutish, and long-drawn-out war on terror has only spawned more terrorism, despite successive regimes in Washington and their Western allies trying to conceal the truth. 20 years on, the war-ravaged country again finds itself at a crossroads. The Taliban fighters are back in power. Al-Qaeda is still around and thriving, while Daesh terrorist group has quietly and stunningly made its way from Iraq and Syria to Afghanistan. That's how America's ominous presence breeds terrorism rather than annihilating it. In the aftermath of the suspicious 9/11 attacks, Americans vowed to crush every terrorist group within their reach, including Al-Qaeda. Former U.S. President George W. Bush famously declared on 20th of September 2001, "The U.S. war on terror begins with Al-Qaeda, but does not end there." The impudence was clearly evident. invasion of Afghanistan less than a month after four hijacked American planes crashed into landmark buildings in New York and Washington on 11th of September 2001, killing 2,977 people, was reckless, poorly planned, and shoddily executed. As a U.S. dispatch, long-range B-52, Stratofortress strategic bombers, AC-130, Spectre gunships, and MQ-9 Reaper drones to flatten the Tora Bora cave complex in eastern Afghanistan, where Osama bin Laden was reported to be hiding, Barbara Lee was the only U.S. congresswoman to vote against authorizing what was to turn out to be America's longest war in history. Barbara Lee was labeled a traitor by those who championed the military invasion that incurred an astronomically high cost, with innocent Afghan civilians bearing the brunt. The mindless war found support among both U.S. Republicans and Democrats as they rallied behind George W. Bush and his hawkish defense secretary, Donald Rumsfeld, to exact the revenge. The bombing campaign was launched on 7th of October 2001 under pretext of decimating the Taliban and Al-Qaeda and capturing the 9/11 mastermind Osama bin Laden, the former CIA ally and the founder of Al-Qaeda, who was apparently hosted by the Taliban. The core objective of the three-week bombing campaign, dubbed Operation Enduring Freedom, was achieved in less than 3 months. But the Americans decided against quitting Afghanistan. There was certainly more to it than that, beyond the bluff and bluster of fighting terrorism. If eliminating Al-Qaeda and the Taliban or taking out Osama bin Laden were prime objectives of the military invasion, the U.S.-led Allied troops would have called it quits long ago. But the aim was to occupy Afghanistan to make the mineral-rich country strategically located between Central and South Asia subservient to the West. Clear from the way George W. Bush and Donald Rumsfeld snubbed the Taliban's offer of a truce to avoid confrontation. Before the bombardment began, the group offered to hand over Osama bin Laden to a third country for trial and even agreed to lay down arms and recognize the government in Kabul led by Hamid Karzai. The offers were spurned, leading to a 20-year military adventure that ended in the worst U.S. military and strategic debacle. The American public, who initially supported the idea of military action against the perpetrators of the 9/11 attacks, eventually became its fierce opponents, as the futile war dragged on for years, metamorphosing into the worst U.S. foreign policy disaster. For 20 years, the war in Afghanistan remained an enigma for the successive U.S. administrations, from George W. Bush to Joe Biden. After invading the country and destroying it beyond recognition, George W. Bush abandoned Afghanistan and launched another costly military adventure in neighboring Iraq in 2003. Both experiments proved counterproductive. His successor, Barack Obama, refocused on Afghanistan, killing bin Laden 10 years after the suspicious 9/11 attacks, not in the mountains of Afghanistan, but in the Pakistani city of Abbottabad, a short jog from a military base. Barack Obama then began the drawdown, but stopped short of complete withdrawal of U.S. forces from Afghanistan. Years later, his successor Donald Trump signed a deal with the Taliban, pledging to withdraw American occupying forces from Afghanistan. It was the same militant group his fellow Republican president George W. Bush once vowed to decimate. Donald Trump was consigned to the dustbin of history before he could execute the plan. It was his successor Joe Biden, his political rival, who finally pulled the plug on America's longest war. The disastrous war ended in August of 2021, the way it started in October of 2001, in a violent, disorderly, shambolic, reckless fashion. Amidst the chaotic evacuation of Kabul's Hamid Karzai International Airport, a Daesh suicide bomber blew himself up, killing more than 200 people, including 13 U.S. service members. The ghastly incident underscored not only the vulnerability of ordinary Afghans, but also the U.S. failure to eliminate the threat of terrorism in Afghanistan. More importantly, it also blew the lid off the sinister interventionism and hegemonic ambitions of the U.S. military-industrial complex in foreign lands, from Somalia to Afghanistan. As reporters later revealed, many of those killed at the Kabul airport didn't fall to suicide bombings but to indiscriminate firefight by American occupation forces. More civilians were to perish hours later in the U.S. drone strike, including Afghan women and children. So, as some pundits would argue, 20 years after the doomed U.S. military mission began in Afghanistan, Osama bin Laden has won the war posthumously. The American presence in the war-ravaged country, often described as the graveyard of empires, not only failed to wipe out the threat of terrorism, but it actually fanned its flames.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz for Indian subcontinent, and FM, 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا ونبينا ومولانا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته dear listeners welcome to another program of Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio. Now, some people question, why do you cry so much over the martyrdom of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam? It has been so many years, you know, it's finished. You know, I've heard some of these people say that, you know, every year you do it. There are many reasons why it should be done every year. But even then, there were those who cried for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam before it even happened. And none more so important than the father of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. It is Amir al-Mu'mineen, Ali ibn Abi Talib, alayhi salam. In the tradition, it is mentioned that, and the tradition is from Imam Baqir, alayhi salam, who mentions that one day Amir al-Mu'mineen, alayhi salam, along with two of his companions, were passing over a particular land. And as they were passing, the land that they happened to pass was Karbala, was the land of Iraq. And as they were passing over that particular land, the companions saw that the eyes of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam began filling with tears. And he said to them that this is the resting place of their animals. Whose animals? And the animals of Imam al-Hussein, those camels and horses that brought the family members of Imam Ali alayhi salam to this land. And this is where the luggage shall be laid. Basically, the tents shall be laid here. You know, the things that they brought with them shall be laid here. And then the Imam said, and it is here that their blood shall be shed. This is where, you know, they will be killed, they will be slaughtered. You know, they will be absolutely annihilated. And then the Imam alayhi salam continues and says, blessed are you, O earth, that the blood of the beloved shall be spilled upon you. So here we see that the Imam alayhi salam, mentioning the event of Karbala to two of his companions even before it took place, and saying that no, the earth is a blessed earth, because why? A specific type of blood will be spilt on it in a very vicious manner. Therefore we see that one of the reasons that the earth of Karbala is so important, and it is, you know, a very emphasized mustahab and recommended act to pray upon the earth of Karbala, is because of the blessedness of that earth. We know that the earth itself and places are not equal. And this is one of the reasons why Karbala is so special. The earth is so special is because of the blood that was spilt on it. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to enable us to be of those who do the ziyarah of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam fi dunya wal akhirah, in this world and the hereafter, inshaAllah. Until next time, my dear brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Oh, here I am pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, oh, I am lost for sure. Oh Lord, here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant.